student at Columbia Seminary in the 60s. In the summers, he was attending Pensacola Theological Institute. Now he takes a tiptoe through the tulips in Holland. And this is the influence of the CRCs in the Southern Presbyterian Church in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I take heed to what Doug Wilson said earlier. If every censorious comment was tape-recorded, we'd stand before God and have to give account for it. God does tape-record our conversations, but it made me realize that these conversations are being tape-recorded, and I don't want to be careful about what I say about each one of these individuals. But these are men who were very influential. Start with William Hendrickson. His commentaries, most of you have his commentaries. I've used his commentaries for years. Spoke at the Pensacola Institute in 1963 as a seminary student then, and or just graduated from Belhaven then. And he spoke on the prophets, and as he spoke, he would quote chapters of the prophets. And he would quote for several verses, and then he would say, "Oh, I can't stop there. I have to go on." And he would go on to the end of the chapter in his quote. And some of us sat on the steps with him outside the steps at McElwain, and he was telling us, he said, "How do you learn the scripture?" He said, "Well, in the early days, I tried to use all my time as wisely as I could." He had a 30-minute commute somewhere. He was on a subway. I forget where it was, but he. He said, "At 30 minutes, he said, I decided that I would try to memorize the book of Hebrews in Greek. I mean, I'm sorry, the book of Ephesians in Greek." And we said to him, do you still remember?" He said, "Oh yes, yeah, still remember." And he said, "Could you quote it for us?" So he quoted. He started with the first word of Hebrews and quoted the first chapter. I mean, of Ephesians, quoted the first chapter of Hebrews in Greek of Ephesians for us in Greek, and it was just so riveting to us as seminary students to think how we struggle with Greek, and this man had mastered it like this and was being so widely used of God. Two men, of course, known to most of you, Simon Kistemacher and Gerard Van Groningen at RTS, and they spoke at the Pensacola Institute as well as taught at the seminary. Peter Y. DeYoung, a priest at Pensacola several years, preached all around through the South, very influential. Joel Niederhood, perhaps best known because of Back to God Hour. And at one point, he spoke at Pensacola in 1987. At one point, the Christian Education Committee of the PCA was considering joint sponsorship of the Back to God Hour. So it was a committee. I was on the committee that went up to Chicago and met with Joel Niederhood and discussed the possibility of the PCA being joint sponsors of the Back to God Hour. And what he explained to us was that they would welcome our financial support, but all of the preachers would always be for all time CRC on the Back to God Hour. And that we left shaking our heads saying, "Well, if you ain't Dutch, you ain't much." So we did. I had a secretary for a while at Jackson who had that bumper sticker on her car. One man that I really have did not cross my mind until Steve Wallace reminded me of him, and that was Adrian DeYoung. About 1911 to 1977, served several pastorates in the South, and he was called to teach homiletics at RTS, and he died. He died just before he began teaching there. He had been a pallbearer of Machen. He was in a senior class at Westminster Seminary and was a pallbearer of J. Gresham Machen. Probably best known in the PCA today by the fact that he had three daughters who all married PCA ministers, Bobby Penny, Randall Yelverton, and Steve Wallace, who's been at the conference here this week. A great man of God who was greatly used in those days. One other I might mention is Wilhelm van Gameren. Because of the influence he had at Reformed Seminary teaching the framework hypothesis, that was the kind of the beginning of the emphasis of that theory into Southern Reformed thinking among very conservative Reformed people. Also, probably one of the big influences was the amillennialism of all these Dutch men, and that influence at Westminster Seminary and then in the South as well, because of the mention that the revival of the Reformed faith in the South in the 50s really was an amillennial revival. Then Reformed Theological Seminary. A lot of you gone there and know more about it than I do. Began in 1965 as the Reformed Theological Institute. I still have a brochure in my file that shows Morton Smith teaching at the blackboard, and it's on television in Jackson. He had a Sunday school, not a Sunday school class, but a class that he taught on television in Jackson, taught the Bible. And then the classes formally began as a seminary September 1966. This was the year that I graduated from Columbia Seminary. During that year, when I was at Columbia Seminary, I sent checks monthly to Reformed Seminary, sent my tithe to Reformed Seminary at that point, and was to some degree involved there in the plans that were being made to start the seminary. But I was a seminary student. Some transferred from Columbia. Remember, I mentioned that Columbia Seminary was the seminary that was replaced by Reformed Seminary, even though it was patterned after Westminster Seminary. It was seeking to the early men who started Reformed Seminary, many of them gone to Columbia, and they were seeking to provide an alternative to Columbia, which is, at that time was still the most conservative of the four PCUS seminaries. I knew several men who transferred from Columbia my senior year, who started that earlier years and ended up in the first class at RTS. So that's where things were chronologically. The one thing that sticks in my mind is I was rooming with a dear brother, Tom Ellis, and Tom, known for years, he had the nickname the Mouse because he from some mannerisms that he had, and you all know the Mouse, don't you? And he very studious fellow that would just be quiet to himself, not say very much. And on one occasion, he was studying there in the corner, and Randall Yelverton came into the room, and he started talking with me and asking me, should I consider going to Reformed Seminary? Should I consider transferring? He was just laboring over, thinking about it. And at that point, Tom Ellis jumped up from his desk, kicked his chair across the room, and raised his hand to heaven and shouted, flee, 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 flee from this place. And and Randall did flee. And several others, Gene Case was here last year at the conference, several others fled. And they were in the early classes at Reformed Seminary. The original faculty of Reformed Seminary, basically sound Reformed men, you know, some variations among them, James DeYoung, Albert Freund, William McElwain, Jack B. Scott, Wilson Minton used to call him Jack B. Nimble, Jack B. Scott, James E. Moore, we've mentioned, Robert F. Gribble, Richard Bodie, and Morton H. Smith. Of course, Morton Smith, again, is the founding theologian of the PCA and of here at this point of Reformed Seminary. Reformed Seminary was started, that is, it was funded by ruling elders. Purposely, some of you correct me if you think this is wrong, but I believe that the ruling elders had the attitude that it was the teaching elders that got us into this mess, and now the ruling elders are going to get us out of this mess. And they only allowed one teaching elder on the board of trustees, and that was Sam Patterson, who was an evangelist, not a theologian. We're all theologians, but he was not a studied theologian. He was the only teaching elder on the board. Now, there was a little bit of pressure later on to establish a ministerial advisory subcommittee, so that was done. But the men who were on the ministerial advisory subcommittee were not really of the same theological knowledge and even views as the men who were teaching on the faculty. Basically conservative men, but not strongly Reformed men. There were things that happened along the way that the seminary had began to move in the early days. Well, as late as 1970, Morton Smith invited R.J. Rushdooney to speak. He did. I heard him speak in chapel. I had brought a man from Louisiana to consider going to Reformed Seminary, and we sat in chapel and heard R.J. Rushdooney speak, and it was not his being there was not controversial at all at that point. I think that Morton had R.J. Rushdooney speak several times. But there came a point, and this point was in 1979, when Morton Smith was forced to choose between being stated clerk of the PCA and the professor at RTS. and he left in 1979. He came to Jackson in 1954. He left Jackson in 1979. And I have suggested to you that that is the period, basically from 55 to 80, where there was a revival of the Reformed faith in the South. I think those were the days when Morton Smith was in Jackson, Mississippi. The issue as to what has happened to the seminary, I would say, is in terms of respectability. I'm going to say the same thing about the PCA. It began in a way that was considered very off-brand. My dad often used the term off-brand for people who were in the OPC or people who were not Southern Presbyterians or who were, you know, in Reformed Seminary. Interesting that in years to come, my dad's successor was a graduate of RTS, and that was quite a turn of events. But the issue of respectability, I think what happened with RTS and with the PCA is that in the beginning it was despised, it was maligned, misunderstood, accused of being racist, and all of these things. And slowly, over a long period of time, respectability was gained. And I believe that respectability became a god. And that respectability, it was determined, would not be lost, no matter what. And that, I think, is probably at the root of problems in seminaries today and in denominations today. Same time, back to the PCUS. The PCA has not been formed yet at this time. There was the Mack Hart case. I could spend a lot of time about this. This is a very, very important time. Trinity Presbyterian Church in Meridian. A man came there who was Felix Gere's son-in-law. Felix Gere was professor of theology at Columbia Seminary. His son-in-law came to Mississippi, and the issue of inerrancy was raised. He denied the inerrancy of Scripture. He said he believed in the infallibility of Scripture, but he believed that it was infallible only in the areas of faith and practice. I'm not sure what other areas there are than faith and practice, but he said it was infallible in areas of faith and practice, but not inerrant. And great controversy raged during that time. Dr. Smith was involved in it, and many other people. I was kind of observing it as a student, and Mack Hart was never received as a member of Central Mississippi Presbytery, but it was appealed to the Synod. The Synod allowed him to stay at the church for 4 years before it was resolved. Never was resolved. He had a four-year pastorate there, moved on, and was received readily by another presbytery, and the term ecclesiastical adultery was used. He was in a situation of ecclesiastical adultery there. One interesting point to me was that I heard this report of this meeting where he was being examined on Paul Harvey news. And Paul Harvey was saying, well, you can't believe what they're talking about down in Mississippi. Presbyterians down in Mississippi are talking about whether Jonah was swallowed by a whale. He said a whale instead of a big fish. But he said, you can't believe that, can you? And what really occurred to me was that's about as far as it got in the South with the controversy raging in the South. In the North, with Machen and the formation of Westminster Seminary, it was daily headlines on the front page of the New York Times. But now, at this point, things had moved so far, and it was so downplayed in the South that the only mention of that case was on Paul Harvey News. OPC and the RPCES were there. Most of us knew that these existed, but they were far away, and we knew very little about them. It would be a very radical step to join them. A few did. It would have been a very radical step to go up to Westminster Seminary. A few did, but most didn't. There were others of us who went through the RPCES as a temporary step into the PCA, of course no PCA at that time, just a continuing church movement, and we in our church in Alexandria, Louisiana, had Robert Rayburn to preach for a week, and he was president of Covenant Seminary at that point. They divided the seminary, the college and the seminary, and he was in St. Louis, but he came and preached for a week. And we were going through the throes of asking to be dismissed by the presbytery, and then we're being investigated, and the people coming into the congregation, they divided up our congregation in Alexandria and had elders to come in, and deliberately had one woman elder to come on this investigation committee. And they interviewed each person in the congregation individually, took them into Sunday school rooms and inquired as to their willingness to leave the PCUS. But Dr. Rayburn was there, and he said to me, well, why don't you just join us, and then we'll dismiss you to the continuing church when it comes about. And so we did. We asked our presbytery, Louisiana presbytery of the PCUS, one of the most liberal presbyteries in the PCUS, to dismiss us to the RPCES. They had no idea who the RPCES was, didn't care too much. They knew there was some far-out, off-brand radical group, and so they did. Now, the RPCES, of course, was basically a new school denomination, and it had separated, the various branches of it separated years ago from Carl McIntyre and the Bible Presbyterian Church, and the issues of division with the OPC were things like premillennialism and total abstinence. Those were important issues. And later on, you know, there was a joining and receiving in which the RPCES just finally gave up, said to the PCA, take us just as we are without one plea, and we will give up everything. We'll give you covenants. We'll give you Covenant College. We'll give you, we'll take your Book of Church Order. We'll take your Confession of Faith the way it is, everything else. And of course, the OPC was not willing to do that. The OPC said, no, we'll have a merger, a negotiated merger. We'll sit down and discuss it. And the PCA said, no doing. If you want to join us, you give up like the RPCES did, and we'll take you lock, stock, and barrel. And so the OPC, of course, is still separate from the PCA, and many from the OPC have quietly joined presbyteries of the PCA. So that has, you might say, strengthened the OPC to some degree, because those who are interested in joining the PCA have strengthened the OPC. It was interesting to me that at the first General Assembly of the PCA the old Briarwood Church in Birmingham, sitting up in the balcony was Carl McIntyre, looking on and observing. And then, of course, after in the Christian Beacon, he castigated not only PCA, but the EPC, RPCES, and all the others together. Now, during this time, going back to Reformed Seminary, there were young men coming out of the seminary, young Turks, who were zealous for the faith. They were going out and preaching election, preaching the doctrine that had been neglected for a long time. Some of them, sometimes perhaps a little bit unwisely, not being judicious and being careful, being going at a gradual pace and teaching the people, but they were aflame with zeal for the newly discovered Reformed faith, and there erupted a controversy called the TR controversy. And there came, you've been hearing the phrase TR in several of the different speakers, and I'm going to now explain to you what a TR is and where the TRs came from. There was an article in the Presbyterian Journal called Lo, the TR. Now, by this time, the men had graduated from Reformed, and they were in pastorates, just in the pastorate a year or two. And the article said, there he is, the TR. He's, paraphrasing now, he's this harsh, unloving young guy who is very unwise, and he goes out and beats people over the head with the 5 points of Calvinism, and he loves to exercise church discipline, as though anyone in his right mind loves to exercise church discipline. But that's what was being said. Now, who were these TRs? Number one was the man today called Dr. Joseph Piper. He's been preaching to us today. If you had to single out one TR in the midst of that controversy, he was the TR. And I don't know if the Lo, the TR was written particularly about him, but he was one of them. Not sure that all the others would still want to be called TRs today. Wayne Herring, the other Rodney King. Not the one who said, can't we all just get along? Bill Smith, John Reeves, Charlie Chase, Wayne Rogers, Vaughn Hathaway, who was already in the pastor sometime. And there was a phenomenon called the Mountain TR. And I didn't know these men that well because they weren't from Mississippi, but there was a group in Virginia's who were men such as Pete Hurst and Byron Snapp, Joe Moorcraft, Larry Ball, and then the little second generation, Brent Bradley, who's here this week, was involved there. And this was the formation of what became Westminster Presbytery, which was at one time one of the strongest Reformed presbyteries in the PCA. But there are problems there now, and the influence is beginning to wane somewhat. The thing I think that should be pointed out is that in the journal article, Aiken Taylor said, these men call themselves TRs, and the idea was they called themselves truly Reformed in the sense that we are the truly Reformed and no one else is. Now, the word actually, the T actually was thoroughly Reformed, which meant consistently Reformed, and what they were saying was, we want to be consistently Reformed, and by that they meant we want to be consistently biblical, and therefore we want to be truly Reformed, thoroughly Reformed. I remember Greg Bonson used to say, what's the alternative, begrudgingly Reformed, or weakly Reformed, or inconsistently Reformed? That's what others perhaps wanted to be. But they form Westminster, the ones in the mountains form Westminster Presbytery, and others Mississippi and close at hand, basically. Now, the founding of the PCA, we could certainly spend a whole session on this easily. I was involved in the formation of the PCA largely because of the sparsity of conservative churches in Louisiana. There were just a few conservative PCA churches in Louisiana, about three or four. And there were 20 sessions. They were seeking to have 20 sessions to call the convocation of sessions. This was to be a call by sessions of local churches. And they were seeking a geographical distribution of these churches. They were seeking the largest, most influential churches. So you had First Church in Jackson, Briarwood, and the other churches that called the convocation. But there was none in Louisiana. So they called me up and said, would your session be willing to be one of the sessions that calls for the convocation of sessions? And so what was called then the Jackson Street Church, name changed now. Some people here from that congregation now, Grace Presbyterian Church in Alexandria, but it was at the time Jackson Street Church. I was the pastor, and so we were one of the 20 sessions that called for the convocation of sessions in 1973. And Steve has brought me out of the closet there when he introduced me earlier and said that I usually don't let people know that I was the one who made the motion of the convocation of sessions. I think I was about 31 years old there, and I don't want to get the blame for it, and I don't get any credit for it. So if you tell anybody who really loves PCA, they don't give you any credit for it. So I try to just keep it quiet. But what I remember was that they were going to Westminster Church in Atlanta. That you remember the successor of the church where Peter Marshall had preached in downtown Atlanta, now moved out to the suburbs, and a large PCUS church, evangelical church, the only one really in Atlanta. And the debate kind of got, like it does so often, it got into the debate before there was even a motion on the floor, and I kept thinking, well, there's no motion on the floor, and nobody's even made a motion. So I started writing, I'll write out this motion, and I'll get up and make it. So I had a little tape recorder there, turned on my tape recorder, went up to the microphone, and moved that this convocation of sessions call for the establishment in 1973 of a new denomination, true to the Scriptures, the Reformed faith, and faithful to the Great Commission. That was the phrase that everybody was using at that time. And underscored in 1973, because there was a debate, some were saying, well, it has to be started sometime, but not this year. There's got to be a lot of water under the bridge before this takes place. But the motion said in 1973, and then the debate began, and of course nobody ever remembered who made the motion, because the debate still went on for hours and hours. And the speeches that I remember in opposition to leaving were by John R. DeWitt and by Gary Aiken. from Columbia, South Carolina. Those two men made the most eloquent and impassioned speeches against, and Dr. DeWitt said, "I am afraid of the sin of schism," and made a very eloquent speech. The speech that was most persuasive and most powerful in favor of leaving was by Donald Dunkerley from McElwain Church in Pensacola. Donald died just a few months ago. There were four organizations then that were set up. They already were established, but four organizations went together to form the PCA. And they were the Presbyterian Journal, Presbyterian Evangelistic Fellowship. The organization of ministers was Presbyterian Churchmen United. I was the Louisiana contact man for Presbyterian Churchmen United and concerned Presbyterians, the lay people or ruling elders and lay people. And all of these organizations, you know, looking back, I would say were basically a new school in their orientation. The Presbyterian Journal, of course, L. Nelson Bell had started it to oppose the union with the Northern Presbyterian Church, and they had defeated the union with the Northern Presbyterian Church, which was proposed for 1954. And then, of course, they called G. Aiken Taylor to be the editor, and he was for many years and was very influential in the founding of the PCA. The Presbyterian Evangelistic Fellowship had been started by Bill Hill and William E. Hill, and then others, Ben Wilkinson, others followed him in the PEF. PEF, of course, is an organization. Alonzo Ramirez is funded through PEF, which is very, very interesting. PEF, over the years, I've had PEF evangelists speak in churches, and they are basically, oriented toward the altar call or the invitation system and that kind of thing in their evangelism. They would certainly profess to believe in the five points of Calvinism. But then the Presbyterian Churchmen United, the chairman was Donald Patterson, First Presbyterian Church in Jackson, and the coordinator was Paul Settle, was a friend of Paul's during those years, and he was the coordinator. Concerned Presbyterians, the layman was headed by Jack Williamson and Kenneth S. Kies, wealthy Miami realtor. And we were up in, when I was visiting Morton Smith in October, we went up to Ridgehaven, looked around, and drove by a little cemetery there, and it said, "Here's Ridgehaven Cemetery," and we got out to see whose grave, only two graves there, and they were Mr. and Mrs. Kies. They were buried there on the side of the mountain, just by the side of the road, and looked at his tombstone. One thing that struck me was very interesting, and I want to ask you, does anybody here know what the S stands for in Kenneth S. Kies? Schofield. Kenneth Schofield Kies. I don't know whether that was his parents named him after C.I. Schofield or not, but that has become a standard trivia question in our Presbytery's church history exam. What does the S in Kenneth Kies stand for? The organizing committee was a committee of 40. I was on the organizing committee, and there were alternates to that committee, so at times larger, times smaller than 40. And I want to ask you the question today in particular. This is getting down to the nub of the issue. How many knowledgeable, consistently reformed men were on the organizing committee of the PCA? I would say one, Morton H. Smith. There was one man who knew a lot of Reformed theology, had Reformed people in his congregation, speak in his congregation, and then eventually got involved in the bureaucracy of the PCA and would be very, I think, pretty far from that theology today. I was certainly not one of those consistently Reformed, seeking to be consistently Reformed men at that time. And that's why I suggest to you that, as I said concerning the Pensacola Institute, and as I said concerning Reformed Seminary, it was seriously flawed from the beginning and has always been basically a new school denomination. I think the defining moment in the meetings of a committee of 40 for me was the time when Frank Barker exhorted the committee and said, "There's a problem that we must be aware of and we must be concerned about. There is a group of men, basically young men, who call themselves TRs, and they are going to be a problem. And I've got some of them, he said, in my congregation, and he began to describe, he said, they don't like the methods of Campus Crusade for Christ. They believe in strongly believe in preaching the 5 points of Calvinism, and they believe in church discipline. And he began to explain what a TR was, and as he did, I thought to myself, you know, that's kind of what I believe. And I'm kind of moving, and that's kind of the direction I knew some of these men, and I said, I think they're on the right track. I think they're moving in the right direction. And so that's what the Committee of 40 was like. The issues were spelled out, at least the constitutional issues were spelled out in Morton Smith's How Is the Goal Become Dim in 1973. There were other issues other than just the constitutional issues here in Journal, but he never actually left the PCUS. And at that meeting, the PCUS in Montreat, L. Nelson Bell, as they got to the discussion on abortion, asked that someone else take the chair as moderator, and he came down to the floor and spoke on the issue. And he called down the judgment of God upon the PCUS. He said, God, if we pass this, if we continue to support abortion, God will judge this denomination. It's prophetic preaching to the General Assembly. A stirring speech that he gave. And then again, he himself never left. Now, when the new Concerned Presbyterians, that people are a new group now today, is calling themselves Concerned Presbyterians, and part of the reason for that that name, of course, is in your eye to the old Concerned Presbyterians, who were not at all old school type Presbyterians, saying now the time has come for us to be concerned again, as we were concerned when we left the PCUS. And there's been a lot of debate about what was intended by the originators of the PCA, the Committee of 40 and others. And so discussion and debate between two men, really, Morton Smith and Kennedy Smart. And of course, they were classmates and both began Westminster Seminary together in 1950. Kennedy Smart wrote the members of the committee that were left in 1993. He wrote the members of the Committee of 40 and the alternatives, and he said in his letter that he sent out widely, there were 35 who were still living and still in the PCA, so there may have been 50 or so of everybody altogether, and 35 were still living, still in the PCA, and he heard from 30 of those 35. I didn't write back. I just didn't have the heart to write back. I knew what he's looking for, and I just didn't write back. Shame on me, should have. This is what his letter said. In listing their 5 most important items, 27 listed a strong evangelistic church planning and world missions emphasis, and number 1, 27. 23 listed scriptural inerrancy, and 21 listed faithfulness to the Reformed faith and the ordination vows. 18 said they were hoping to see a denomination that would reach out in love to cooperate with Bible-believing brothers and other denominations and organizations which were evangelical, though not necessarily Reformed. 10 said they wanted to avoid a narrow Pharisaism, and 9 said they wanted a denomination that would avoid heavy-handed top-down authority. 9 listed observable love and trust, and 7 parity at all levels. Only 1, reflecting the current discussion, said he wanted the PCA to hold to strict subscriptionism, and 4 said they did not envision strict subscriptionism. And then Kennedy Smart went on to say, actually, strict subscription was never discussed in the foundation stages of the PCA. Interestingly, 4 mentioned total abstinence as one of their top priorities. There was no mention of the regulative principle of worship or of old school, new school theology. And then Kennedy concluded his letter by saying, for those of you who were not around in those days, you just have to understand that the issues were largely determined by the experiences of the previous 25 years, meaning it was liberal versus conservative. That was the basic division. And now, what about the debate? Is it right to say now that the denomination has moved away from being consistently Reformed
I would say Kennedy Smart is right. He is right in what he says. I think there's no question about it. I talked to Dr. Smith on the phone the other night. He said he conceded, yes, I think he was right. He said, I intended for it to be an old school denomination. I wrote those things, and they all signed them. They did not understand what they were signing. And my impression was that we said in those days, we are going to take our stand on the Westminster Confession of Faith and the Catechisms, and we're going to read them and find out what's in there as we go along. And some people read those things and said, hey, this is great stuff we took our stand on here. And some said, wow, I don't like that. And then divisions began to occur. Now, the early people in the PCA were determined not to split because of the watching world and because of the watching liberals, especially. The Presbyterian Outlook, the liberal organ in the PCUS, was writing editorials all the way through saying, just wait. They're going to split the first year, second year, third year. They're going to split all the way along. And we were saying, whatever happens, we are not going to split. Now, that's why there's a lot of that mentality in the PCA today from those who are around all this time. We are not going to split no matter what. Again, I would say that the issue today is respectability, public relations. We were despised. We were called all kinds of names. You had to go through agony. You know, that's one of the things today to me as an old guy is that is such a blessing that I don't have the emotional pressure that I have had in those days. You can't imagine. Some of you, of course, went through it, but the intense emotional pressure when you came to taking votes in your congregation. Is the congregation going to vote? Is it going to be 100%? What is the presbytery going to do? And to some degree, you know, those kind of emotional pressures have been taken away from us. But despised in the early days, the determination was the PCA is going to gain respectability. And we gained respectability. And that respectability is not going to be lost, no matter what. We set up competing committees that were competing for the money. And what the General Assembly became very quickly, I believe, was public relations programs that were designed to raise money for the different committees. Each one of them had each year their own slide tape presentation showing how great they were. And I felt like in the years that followed that I could expect at any moment for someone to stand up and say, now let's all stand and sing how great we are. That's where we went. Years ago, when I went to North Avenue Church when I was a seminary student, and Dr. Vernon Broyles, they were having a great missions conference. It was still relatively conservative at that time, and they had one of these big thermometers, you know, as they kept putting the red higher and higher until finally pledges were coming in, and it burst out the top, and Dr. Vernon Broyles jumped up into the podium, and he said, now let's stand together and sing How Great I Am. And he never realized what he'd said. That was my feeling about the PCA, how great we are. And when anybody says we ought to be on our faces before God, it's being disloyal. So the PCA began, and very soon there were problems. There was a meeting at Rosedown Plantation near Natchez just a few years later, trying to iron out some of the differences between men. It was organized by Dick Ayers, a ruling elder at the Jackson Street Church, and Bob Vincent, the pastor of the church there. And at that meeting were G. Aiken Taylor, Frank Barker, Paul Settle, Joe Piper, Palmer Robertson, and me, and several others. I forget who else was there. But we spent a couple of days sleeping there, praying together, talking about the differences, walking around the plantation and saying what's going to come. These differences. This is very early now. This has been many years ago. I was involved in the founding of Louisiana Presbytery when I was at Alexandria. I came here very briefly to Monroe with a little Bible study group going on. I think there's maybe one person that's left around that was still here at that little Bible study group. And So we were involved, at least in a very, very small way, in the founding of a PCA church in Monroe. There were about four or five ministers in the PCA in Louisiana, and I don't know that any of us at that point knew what it meant to be consistently reformed. Now, I'm going to discuss the theonomy controversy in 2.5 minutes here. Greg Bahnsen came to RTS in 1976. He was 27 years old, a seminary professor at 27. He knew a lot. He probably knew more than any professor there. He might have known as much as all the professors there combined. He had come as a graduate of Westminster Seminary. He was working on his PhD at that time. He'd gotten his master's degree from Westminster Seminary. And the climate, he said, at Westminster Seminary was you discussed theological issues, you debated in class, you arm wrestled over these things, and then they all went out to coffee and had a good time enjoying each other's fellowship. But he found when he came to the South, to RTS in Jackson, that to be a gentleman, be a Southern gentleman, you didn't get involved. You didn't say other people were wrong. You said, "Well, I might differ. Let's talk about this, and we might differ about this something. Let's see if we can." And you would spend at least the first 5 minutes telling what a wonderful person you thought he was and all of his good qualities before you would ever suggest that he was wrong about something. And of course, Greg's personality was to get to the heart of the issue. And you are wrong here. I'm going to show you 15 ways that you're wrong. And here are the subdivisions of each of these ways. And so Greg spoke often in faculty meetings. He spoke on virtually every issue in faculty meeting. And I was Greg's pastor during those days and perhaps his closest friend during the controversy. I would have served Greg better if I had counseled him to soften some of the things that he said and did. The seminary handling of the issue was very wrong. Dr. Robert Strong wrote a paper condemning theonomy and circulated among the faculty, and the only way Greg saw it was when one of the students had got a copy of his paper and handed it to him. He didn't even hear anything about it. No one spoke to him about it, but there was a discussion began among the faculty about what was wrong with the book before any discussion with him. And, of course, it became a very, very emotional thing revolving around personalities, and I don't think the issues for years were really discussed intelligently. I read the book in pre-publication form. Greg gave me the book as it came out and as it was printed, and I still have that little, I was looking at it the other day, just a little bound copy of it with little rings around it, not in a binding. And Greg was forced to take a leave of absence from the seminary. He held his ethics class in the fellowship hall at St. Paul Presbyterian Church, and it was packed from wall to wall with some from the community, some from the church, as well as students. It was kind of a rump parliament there where he held his class. And the session of the church met with the president of the seminary, Bob Canada, Luther Whitlock, and with the chairman of the board, Bob Canada. We discussed theonomy. We discussed the counseling, where the counseling program was going at the seminary. And at that point, we determined that we would no longer support the seminary financially. And they told us, "That's fine. Whatever you'd like to do, do whatever you need to do." And I think since then the church has reestablished relationships with the seminary, but they were broken off at that point. Then it came to the PCA. Fred Fowler, at the end of one General Assembly in Grand Rapids, the last thing that was done, he stood up. He was the brother of Paul Fowler, who was a classmate of mine at Columbia Seminary. He was a professor at Reformed Seminary and was writing papers against theonomy at that point. His brother Fred stood up the last motion at the General Assembly. He said, "I move that we study theonomy." And the debate began. And, you don't just move to study something like that. And they weren't going to give it to an ad interim committee. And I'm going to give you another of those Forrest Gump moments, where they weren't going to give it to a committee to study. It would cost a lot of money. They said, "We'll let the Christian Education and Publications Committee handle this issue." And I was on the Christian Education and Publications Committee. So they held a meeting after and said, "Okay, we need to appoint a subcommittee of three men to study the issue of theonomy." So they appointed me and two others to be the PCA, Theonomy Study Committee. And the committee met, and one of the fellows said, "Hey, we all got to all read Theonomy and Christian Ethics. Let me look at your copy." They opened it up, and it said to my faithful pastor, Mickey Snyder. And we went from there. Well, I ended up writing the PCA's decision on Theonomy. I'd written about five pages, and they boiled it down to one sentence. And the sentence was that it would be neither required as orthodoxy nor rejected as a heresy. That became the PCA position. It was tried to diffuse the issue. And it said then, one other sentence said that no view of the law that was consistent with the standards could be held. Any view that was consistent with the standards could be held, and of course it had defined what was consistent with the standards, and didn't interpret the standards at that point at Westminster Confession 19:4, and somehow that phrase that is consistent with the standards was dropped out, and the debate came back about 3 years later on the floor of General Assembly, and they read the statement: no view of the law may be rejected; any view of the law may be held. And somebody said, "Wait a minute! This is you can be a dispensationalist; you can be anything and believe this." And so Morton Smith at that point got up and said, "There has been a phrase that has been left out in the minutes, and that phrase is that is consistent with the standards." And so, of course, that was quickly reinserted into the statement. The debate continues today, and of course the question will be, you know, those of us who are seeking to be consistently reformed and yet have different views of theonomy will have to do a lot of thought, prayer, and discussion together. Let me mention just very briefly two developments with people leaving the PCA, both connected with Reconstruction. I have in the reverse the ones you have in your schedule. I'll do Big Joe first, and then Tyler Wright. Big Joe, of course, refers to none other than Joseph Seymour Craft III. He was known as Big Joe in those days. He's one of the Mountain TRs, also called the Jolly Green Giant by his friends. He established Chalcedon Presbyterian Church in Atlanta in 1974. They had just had their 25th anniversary. Now they have moved to Cumming, Georgia, and bought First Baptist Church. And Joe is got some big plans to try to move Price College to Atlanta and Bonson Seminary to Atlanta if he can convince them to do that. He's working. He's going to establish a radio station, and he's going to take over the world from Atlanta in the year 2025. He left the PCA in 1983. The circumstances were basically that they were requiring theonomy and postmillennialism on the part of all officers of the church. One man said, "No, that's not legitimate," so he appealed to the presbytery, and they believed that the presbytery was going to come in and take over the session. I'm not sure if that was really the case. I think that they would have, Joe believes that they would have lost. If they had stuck it out, I think I knew the chairman of a man on the committee was Chuck DeBartleben, who's now the pastor at McElwain Church, and he maintains that they were getting ready to say, "We don't like it, but we will allow the session to make this. You can make requirements in addition to the questions in the Book of Church Order," and so on. But Joe felt like they were going to take over the congregation, and he and his congregation left in 1983, and it was at that point that he became Pope Joe the First. And Joe is a friend of mine, and I would say that if you were here. And he told me recently, by the way, that he had named his two sons after his two favorite theologians. Did he tell you that story? How one of his sons is John Calvin Moore Craft, and the other is Joseph Seymour Craft the Fourth. And he said, "Guess which one of those is my firstborn?" Joe ran for Congress. He was a friend of Larry McDonald's, who was killed in the Korean plane crash, and Joe ran for Congress and was not elected. If you look at the change in Atlanta, you know, the situation when I was in Atlanta in the 60s at Columbia Seminary, no strongly reformed church of any stripe there. Unless there was some, Tulip Baptist hiding out there somewhere, but no strongly reformed church in Atlanta, and it's quite a change there today.
Then the Tylerites, their phrase was came to be in those days called the Tylerites, and you know, most people could probably think Tylerites were people that planted roses, I guess. But now the term Tylerite came to mean something else, an experiment there from roughly from 1980 to 1990. And Geneva Divinity School was established, and Jim Jordan and I were talking about the events surrounding that on the way up. Ray Sutton was pastor of Westminster Presbyterian Church. There were others there associated with him. Jim and Gary North came in 1980, and Jim tried to give them some sensibilities there, but they didn't listen to him. And but there was a real contribution made from that point, writings and now Biblical Horizons, and Jim's ministry is you know, the result, the offshoot of something that was begun there that is continuing today. For a minute, St. Paul, I don't have the time, I guess, to go into that. I need to stop. If I can just take about 5 more minutes, I'll try to wrap things up. Several are here who were there in the days of St. Paul when I was there, 1975 to 1986. And I'm thankful that things are much more peaceful at St. Paul today. Mark Duncan's here, is now the pastor of St. Paul. We were just talking about the other night how blessed he is and how well things are going there. When I left St. Paul in 1986, I sat down with the elders, and I drew up the number of controversies that had been there during those years, and I came up with 32 controversies. 11 of those controversies were on the level of church-splitting controversies that would easily split the average church. You know, going back to the things that if I'd heard Doug's lecture back in those days, it would probably things would have turned out different. I'd been a lot better off. Moved out, as I said, retired, moved to Florida in 1986, and peace and harmony in a wonderful congregation that loves me, and I don't have enough enemies now from Steve's exhortation last time. I've got to get some enemies there. The only little controversy we had there was Paul Hill killed the abortionist. You know, that was a little ripple, but he had already been excommunicated at that point. And the amazing thing to me was for our congregation to go through that and virtually not cause a ripple among the congregation. The congregation's position was, we trust our elders. They have established the trust of the congregation, and we will stand with our elders. Our elders are men of God who believe the scriptures, and they're seeking to do what is right. And, you know, not a ripple. Amazing, really amazing, had to go through that by God's grace. In the years at St. Paul, when I was there, those 12 years, a complete turnover of the session. All they were about, I think, 8 elders when I came there. When I left, they were 5 elders, and they were all different men. The deacons, I believe, there were about maybe about 8. Eight deacons there, and there were about 8 deacons when I left, but only 2 of them were the same as the ones who had been there before. Just amazing change and turnover in those years. When I came to Jackson, there was a vacuum of expository preaching in Jackson at that period. And seminary students tend to drift around to this church and to that church, and so they began to come to St. Paul. And at the height of that, we had about 50 students and their families. Some of them are students are here now, of course. In those days, Lon Oswalt became an elder there. David Rockett was an elder there later time, and who is now in this church. Of those 50, and now, of course, that was at one period, there may have been as many as 75 students that came through there and left for other places. And as I have contact with some of these men, the question is, how faithful are they? Some have remained very faithful to the Reformed faith, and some have not. During that period, in that church, about a 200-member church, professors who were there, Greg Bonson was there, Dan Morris, now bishop in the Reformed Episcopal Church, Paul Koistra taught Sunday school, became president of Covenant Seminary, and now is the head of Mission to the World and the PCA. Students who were there during that period, Gary DeMar, David Chilton, Steve Wilkins, Jim Jordan, Derek Thomas,
and a few others of slightly less renown than those. People preached during those days: R.J. Rushdoony, Al Martin, John R. DeWitt, Henry Crabbendam, Ian Murray, and many others preached during that period. Morton Smith preached there. I believe the only time he preached there was at my installation. He preached the sermon at my installation at St. Paul in 1975. We go on to influential organizations we could leave out. You know, there's just so many that you could not mention: Reform University Ministries, Mount Olive Tape Library, Christian Studies Center, and so on. It goes on and on. I was going to draw up a list of the people to watch, you know, the key players for the next 50 years, and Jim Jordan said, don't go there. He was wise. Once again, I'm not going there. I'll, if you want to talk to me, I'll tell you what my list, who was on my list. Some of you here are on my list, of course. Then publications. Again, I had a page of publications that we ought to be reading now, but far too long. We couldn't read them all if we tried. The thing about leadership, I think, is that it was said in the PCA when it was formed, there is no leader, and they thought that was a very good thing. They discussed it many times in the organizing committee. They said, we do not have a Machen. They were very conscious of the OPC and its formation. They said, we do not have a Machen today. And the same thing's true today. There is no Machen on the horizon, and there are a lot of very talented, gifted people, but there's no one person to whom the Reformed movement is looking now. And we must give that thought and prayer. It's a good thing in some ways. There's not one charismatic leader in that sense, but in some ways we need the giants of the past to lead us unto the Lord. The issues we'll discuss. I was going to just touch on each one, but I won't even touch on them. Subscription: what is it, to what should we subscribe, and how? What do we mean by subscription? Covenant communion, paedo communion, theonomy: can we live together? How wide? An area of view of the law. The role of women, of course, is now just coming right to the front. Worship: I think the most important issue of all is the issue of worship. Polity and ecclesiology, very important, and the Sabbath. The battle for the Sabbath is over, and we have lost. But it'll have to be restored. It's gone. Now, the PCA has taken a very strong stand. Frank Smith read it to me, I think it was 1986, on the Sabbath, and the confessional position. But in the practice of the people of the churches, it is gone, and will have to be reestablished. Theonomy: my assessment is that the battle is over, and theonomy has won. Not in the sense of all of the particulars of the penal sanctions and all the rest, but in the sense of the nation, the Christians believe, by and large evangelical Christians believing, and you're talking about charismatics and Baptists and anybody you talk to, the idea that Jesus Christ should be king of America, and that the president should bow before him, and every single officer in the nation should bow before him, not only in his private devotions, but when he is making laws and when he is ruling in the courts. I believe that battle has been won. And I think we need to continue to fight the battle. But I think that the basic battle is over. Praise God. Future denomination: I'm not going to call for a new nationwide denomination. I think that the answer in the future is going to be, in the immediate future, is going to be clusters. There's a cluster in Monroe, a cluster in Moscow, there's a cluster in Atlanta, there's a cluster. I'd like to see a cluster in the panhandle of Florida. But they're around Texarkana, here and there. There are these clusters. And I believe that these clusters will, over the years, discuss things together. We need to have church councils in the old sense of church councils, not to, you know, to worship together, yes, but to discuss doctrines and to work on these things. And it will take, it'll take a century in the future. But I want to be basically encouraging to you. I believe that if someone does this 50 years from now, the year 2050, he will very likely mention this conference here today. If the present trend continues, I hope that I'm wrong. If the present trend continues in the PCA, I believe in the next 50 years, and maybe not even the next 50 years, there will be office bearers who are evolutionists. There will be office bearers who deny inerrancy. Women will be ordained. Homosexuality will be tolerated. I hope that that is not the case. I believe that unless the trends are turned around, that will be the case. And I believe it will be one of the great problems is the fear of narrowness, the unwillingness to see that there is an antithesis. I'm not talking about a narrow spirit. We want to avoid that narrow spirit, but we have to be willing to be called narrow. For wide is the gate, and broad is the way that leads to destruction, and many are entering in thereat. But narrow is the gate, and straight is the way that leads to life, and there are few that are finding it. But more will find it. And by God's grace, and through the instrument of the people who are sitting here today, there will be many entering at that gate. Amen. Let us pray together. Let's stand together as we pray. O Lord our God, you are a great God and greatly to be praised. And your greatness is unsearchable. You are working out your purposes as year succeeds to year. You are working out your purposes, and the time is drawing near, that time when the earth shall be filled with the knowledge of the glory of God as the waters cover the sea. May it be so. May we be encouraged, and may we see progress in our own lifetimes, in our own ministries. O Lord God, lay hold of those men who are here for this conference, some of whom are discouraged and frustrated. They feel like they're beating their heads against the wall. Empower them, O Lord, to be faithful servants. Uphold them and sustain them and use them for your glory. Correct their sins. Correct our sins. Use us for your glory. We thank you now for our fellowship. We thank you for the food that has been provided here for us.